You have reached the second floor. Ahead lie the terrors of Atlantean PC Engine Part 2. Welcome to part two of our discussion about the PC Engine. This is your host, Michelle Belmont, and we're here with the unnamed PC Engine developer of Atlantean, who will talk to us more about how he came into that. So let's get started right away. Okay, so let's get into your stuff. So you make games for this system. Like, as far as I know, you made the first PC Engine game in 25 years. Like, a view card game in 25 years.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about that. Like, how did that happen? Like, was it like Back to the Future where you like fell off your toilet and saw like the flux capacitor or something? Like, you had this image of a hue card in your brain. You said, I have to make a hue card game now. How did that come to being?
Well, no, what happened is basically, I guess I got bored.
It's close enough. I mean, falling off your toilet, bored, it's not that different.
Well, since I grew up with it, I already knew what it was. One day, I guess in college, I just got bored because I'd already done programming. You know, I grew up with, like, a Commodore 64 and the Amiga and stuff, and I'd done programming. But then I don't remember the exact specifics. I was messing with the Commodore 64. That community got a little toxic because some of the people were just not great. And I went snooping around the TurboGrafx stuff and was like, oh, there's like tools to make games. I'm just going to do this. And I just started pulling stuff down and messing with it. And what ended up happening is my friend, he's a little older. I met him through like other gamers and stuff. His uncle, where everyone refers to him as Old Man, that's like his forum name and stuff. He happened to also be into the TurboGrafx. Like when the TurboGrafx kind of like died in America, he went to Toys R Us and just said, you know, give me one of everything. So he has like this insane collection of crap just out of nowhere. And I started, their house was like a hub where like all like the dorks just kind of hung out. Like we would sit there till like 6 a.m. at times. So I used to just go over there and hang out during college and was working on stuff over there. And I was trying to figure out like the joystick code to like make the guy move around on the screen. And my friend's uncle, Old Man, you know, he's a really smart dude. And sometimes he's a little hard to work with because he's got a strange roundabout way of doing everything that we attribute to like just the fact that he smoked a ton of pot back in the day. So, you know, he saw what I was doing. He was like, oh, that's not how you do that. And he was right that that's not how you do that. But his way of doing it also was like, I don't know if that's how you should do it. But, you know, he showed a bunch of stuff. And then I inadvertently roped him into it because he just got interested in the fact that some random idiot was at his nephew's house trying to make a TurboGrafx game. And that's how the whole thing started. Was me trying to, I had a sprite on the screen and I coded it wrong to where like when you would like move the joystick, it would just get stuck and like keep shooting the guy across the screen even if you weren't touching the button anymore. And he showed me like and explained how it works and stuff. And from there I was like explaining to him what I was trying to do, and this is how Insanity started, was that conversation with him. And I was like, I'm trying to just make this.
Insanity, by the way, the game, not the actual state of being insane, right?
Yeah, not like mentally insane, just the game, yeah. That's how it got started, was because of him. Well, not because of him, but because like over there,
it was the right environment.
Right, and it's hard to, like, sometimes when you're programming stuff, like a lot of people online, they hit those brick walls and they don't have anyone to talk to and they just give up and go do something else. But like, we were kind of feeding off of each other, like, because I had a lot of ideas, because Old Man doesn't play a lot of games, and when he does, he's not good at them. There's certain games he's really good at, and then certain games, like any action game, where he's just not good at. Like, he can't even beat, like, Atlantean. He can't get past, like, the second level. But, you know, so we were, like, feeding off each other, getting everything going, and it just went from there, and it got fun because we both liked the machine a lot, and I'd always be, like, digging around online and finding more stuff and bringing it over, and we were just experimenting. And at the time, the audio was, like, a big problem because chiptunes didn't exist with the homebrew stuff, and we kind of fixed that problem.
Oh.
Like, it started, like, we found some crap. The PSG BIOS, the system BIOS for the CD hardware has a PSG player in it. So I was like, it's there. We just need to figure out how to talk to it. And we found some crap online that people had reverse engineered in like 1996. And from there, I picked up a copy of the Devlo book, the PC Engine like dev kit. They released that for fun after the thing died. It had all this info in it. And I was like, dude, everything's here. We just have to talk to it correctly. And as luck would have it, you know, old man was like, he's a retired computer engineer. Oh. So this is like second nature to him. So we sat there, and I think the first iteration I wrote myself and had some friends help correct, I screwed up like the time intervals, because it's a integer based CPU. There's no floating points. You have to compensate for like the non even divisions where you have like a remainder. I wasn't doing that. So the songs would like fall out of sync as they played, unless if they weren't perfectly tempoed, like they would just slowly go out of whack. So, like, a friend helped fix a lot of that, but that ran like crap in general because it was processing stuff in real time that you could do ahead of time.
Right.
But then we moved into what we have now, and it only took us, I think, like 2 weeks of just sitting there screwing with it until like 3 or 4 in the morning every day. And like the light bulb came on, and I almost threw a laptop out the window. The Devlo book and all the documented stuff has a, like, an equate in the assembly library, like, for, like, the wave buffer, for, like, the waveform. Like, because it's a 32-byte waveform to make the instrument. That's all sitting. You have to, like, load it. Well, for whatever who-knows-why reason, the people that did, like, the Magic Kit PC Engine assembly library thingy, they changed the name of the Define and then left the old one, but, like, changed the address that it goes to, and it just goes to nowhere. So we were basically loading a waveform to nowhere.
Oh.
And I finally looked, and I'm like, they changed the name of this, and I changed like the word wave to wave buff, or it might have been the other way around, but I literally changed like that one thing and then rebuilt and launched our thing, and then all the waveforms started working. And I about flipped the table over, just like flung the laptop out the window like a frisbee. We were sitting there for like 2 or 3 hours trying to figure out why everything that came out was just the default square wave. It was like just a plain ass generic like brr noise.
Why won't you work?
Yeah, because I ripped the waveforms out of Newtopia. You can find where they're at in memory because it's 32 byte. It's easy to find where they stored them in ROM. So I ripped a bunch of the waves out. I was like, you know, these should sound like Newtopia, but we don't have that. And it was very irritating, but we fixed it. And that became what ended up being like the Insanity came out. You can pick chip or CD audio.
Oh.
And then, you know, you can go from there. But every game since then has had chip audio, and it's because of that, like...
Because of
it was
you.
My... Well, yeah, it was because one of the reasons I like the machine is the audio chip. And I basically said, if we can't get the chip-ins to work, I'm not even bothering to finish the stupid game.
Right.
Basically, it was like an all-or-nothing thing where I'm like, we're getting this to work. And we forced it to happen.
So the PSG and the PC Engine, how similar is that to PSG and the MSX?
It's not.
It's not?
No, the PSG in the TurboGrafx is a lot fancier. Mm. It uses 32-byte waveforms, and they're 5-bit amplitudes. The MSX has something very similar that Konami made. It was the SCC.
Okay, so it's closer to the SCC then?
It's almost the same, but it's better. The differences are the PC Engine is 6 channels. The SCC is 5.
Oh, okay.
But the SCC is 8-bit, whereas PCE is 5-bit. So, like, the amplitudes are slightly different.
Huh.
But the PC Engine has stereo panning per channel. The MSX does. It's monos. You don't have panning.
Yeah.
So, and that stupid feature, just having panning on all the channels, is one of the reasons that the sound on the PC Engine stands out. Like, if you listen to Dungeon Explorer, there's, like, 3D sound effects happening with the way the music pans and, like the echo and, like, panning back and forth that they do. It's pretty complicated stuff, and you can't do that with a lot of the other machines because they don't have panning like that. Even the Amiga can't do that. It's got hard left and right panning. Like, if you listen to Amiga music with headphones on, it sounds stupid because you only hear, like, drums on the left or drums on the right. Like, they don't mix to the middle.
Huh.
Because there's... The Amiga has hard left and right. There's no middle.
Huh.
Yeah, so, like, it's kind of dumb. But it's similar to the SCC. That's about the closest sound chip.
Okay.
They sound super similar. Like, if you listen to Metal Gear 2... Solid Snake or Snatcher on the MSX, it sounds like PC Engine music. It's that same weird chirpy kind of,
yeah,
like horn noise. It's the same stuff.
Okay, so the first game you did was Insanity then?
Yeah.
And then after that you did, what would have been next after that?
Pyramid Plunder.
Okay. So Atlantean is probably the most famous one that you've done, I guess.
That's because it was on a Hue card.
Right. So who developed that card, actually?
That was Old Man being Old Man. He has tons of free time because he's retired. It started as a, I wonder if I can do that. Kind of thing, because he looked at the Master System cards and was like, this can't be that hard. The first ones he made, I'm surprised he's not dead. He etched the boards himself. I kid you not, I came over early the one day to his house, and the nut job, I look, he's got fish tanks in his garage with like a car battery and like cabling hooked up to it. He's like running like live current into the fish tank. He did the plating himself. Like the copper plating.
Oh, wow. Like running the traces and everything?
Yeah, and then he's like probably illegally disposed of the leftover crap in the fish tank because he dumped it in the driveway. And then, you know, I still have some of the cards sitting here. Like, I can see where I'm at. They're like hand-etched. Whoa, I don't know if you call it hand-etched. It was like, you know, car battery etched with this MacGyver crap he did. And the boards weren't thick enough, so like you have to stick a, like, he was just taping old credit cards or gift cards to them, and you could jam them in the TurboGrafx, and you put like a crappy Asteroids game on it. It was like, hey, look, it works. And that was how it started. And then from there, I helped him refine the design of it and then moving towards the plastic. And then he experimented with the plastic and the 3D printers, and he's probably going to get cancer from it by now. He was like melting Tide detergent jugs and milk jugs, trying to just experiment with plastic. Some of the cards I have are made out of milk jugs.
What?
Yeah, and like I came over the one day, and this old man is like this skinny, scruffy-looking old dude. Like, he wears like ripped clothing, like jeans with holes in the knees and stuff, shirts that are like so worn out they might as well not be there. But he's got a big beard and like a ponytail, but he's standing there in like his wife's cooking apron with her like oven mitt. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, oh, I'm making Hue card molds. And I'm like, okay. And then I'm standing there talking to him about something I came over there for, and a little like ding timer went off, like an oven timer.
Yeah.
And he walks over to a toaster oven and opens it, and he pulls out these cards that he had tried to make in the toaster oven. And he's standing there with like his wife's pink frilly like baking apron and oven mitts, and he's holding this tray of melted milk cartons and Tide stuff, and he's like, I'm trying to figure out which plastic is the strongest. And I'm just looking at him like, you got to be kidding me. So, like, a bunch, I have, like, the Santa game that we made. It was, like, a spoof of Atlantean for Christmas.
Uh-huh.
Some of the cards I have, it's melted down gallon milk jugs that he made. But, you know, I helped him, like, brainstorm, and we figured out ideas to get the plastic feel right. Then we ended up he got a 3D printer.
Yeah, like a normal adult would do.
Yeah, well, first he went rogue. But, you know, I told him, like, ideas for how to, like, do the card. Like, the way the original card was two pieces, and, like, the board sits on the big plastic piece, and then we were, like, putting another cap over the ROM chip. We would basically use acetone and acetone the card together so, like, it fuses the plastic halves together.
Right.
So that people can't open it. But then, like, eventually I shrunk the board down and then gave it to him. I was like, okay, now the board's half as long. We can do, like, a real hue card where it's a big white plastic tray. And then you just put the black piece down in a little dent at the end.
I see, yeah.
The original Atlanteans, the board runs the full length of the plastic. So
I think I've seen that before. I think they had some at Beep.
Yeah, those were the original ones.
One of these days, I really do want to get that game, because every time I go to Beep and I see that, if I see that game there, it's always being displayed at a time when I don't have money. Like, the times when they don't have a copy on display for me to buy, it's when I have money. And when I don't have money is when it's there.
Sounds about right.
That and Inferno, it's the same thing.
He's got those right now, and I talked to them. I guess they have some left, because I asked if they wanted more, because I was just there, like, 2 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
They have some. I saw one on the shelf. I think it's, like, $80 or something. I don't remember.
I was going to say, are those the same prices in there as they are in America?
No, like, well, he's marking up for the fact that, like, he gets screwed on shipping when I mail them to him.
Ah, okay.
But, like, I cut him a deal because he buys them all, and, like, it's not a wholesale price, but, like, I give him, like, a discount for buying, you know, 30 copies to sell in his store, because, like, he's always been very helpful for me. Like, the one MSX I have, I got from him, and he repaired it for me before he sold it to me. And he was able to track some stuff down for MSX for me to, like, test what I was doing, because I wanted, like, an RGB out MSX. I'm stupid and collect the Toshiba model, so he found me, like, a Toshiba. The case is worn, like, it's super beat up, like, there's, like, spots where the paint is discolored, but it's the wedge keyboard one, not the one I use usually is the HX34, where it's the keyboard is separate.
Is that an MSX one? Is that a one or a two?
It's a two.
It's a two, okay.
It's a two. Yeah, he found me 23F, which is a wedge board one, but it still does RGB out, and it's an MSX2. And he, like, recapped it and did some stuff and fixed it up and then sold it to me, and it's been extremely useful. And since he's always been pretty cool about stuff like that, and I talked him into selling me stuff that I don't think he wanted to sell. But, like, he had a poster, like an MSX advertisement on the wall, and I'm like, I need that. I need to buy that. And I kept asking, and I kept offering him money, and finally he's like, you know what, fine, yeah, you can have it. And I bought it off of him, but I don't think he necessarily wanted to sell it.
Nah, because they have a lot of stuff in there that they use for display that they don't want to sell.
Yeah, he ended up selling it, and what was funny was, like, after that, when they had Atlantean for sale, he put this little card by it explaining that it was, like, this was made by an American dude, and he put, like, a little biography about me. Like,
I've seen it. I've seen it in the store, yeah.
And I think it mentions, like, the advertisement that I bought. The girl that's in it is a pop singer. I'm like, I need that. And
of course.
Like, so it's, like, mentioned in the little biography stick.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, so he's always been a very, like, helpful dude. So it's like, okay, you help me, I help you. Like, here's your discount for helping me, because you helped get hardware and stuff that I need.
Yeah, that's cool. Beep is one of my favorite stores. I've gone in there once or twice and actually mentioned you. And they're always like, I'm like, oh, I have a friend who does this and that, and they're like, oh, really? And I was like, yeah, it's the guy that did Atlanta. I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, you know him? I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, that's cool. And I mean, that's about all it gets me, is that that's cool. But, you know,
yeah.
It's kind of nice to be able to go into a store and say, oh, yeah, I know the guy that made that game.
Yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, I know that idiot.
Yeah. No, I'm going to come in. Next time I'm going to come in, and I'm going to have my podcast on, like, a cassette tape or something, and be like, hey, yeah, me and the Atlantean guy recorded this. And they'll probably be even less interested. But, you know, yeah, so one of the things that I really like about your games is that you sell them in Japan as well as in the U.S., which is really cool for me, because even though I haven't bought one of them yet, I can, which is in itself pretty impressive. A question, actually, for Atlantean, do you have to sell a different version in Japan than you do in the U.S.?
Yeah, when you buy Atlantean's physical copy, you have to tell us what region you want it for.
Mm.
And it's been hilarious, because it was like, I don't know if it was a stupid move on our part or a hilarious move, You can't physically tell the difference looking at them. They look the same. So there have been times where someone resells it on eBay and they don't know. They just say, it's a TurboGrafx version. And someone will buy it and then email me and go, I bought this off eBay and it doesn't work. I'm like, I guarantee you, like I put it in my Duel RX and nothing happens. I'm like, try putting it in a TurboGrafx, what happens? They're like, it works.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, you didn't mark them. Because I guess it was naive on my part to assume that the people buying these weren't going to be reselling them or dumping them on people. But yeah, all the ones that go to Japan are just Japanese region. They won't work in a TurboGrafx. And I think right now I have some spare ones. I need to get new trays and I want to do another batch. They're all Japanese region because in selling them, I took metrics, I guess. Most of the sales were people wanting a Japanese region one.
Oh, really? Oh, I would imagine so. Because there's so many more systems that were produced in Japan than in America, it's just a lot easier to get a PC Engine in Japan.
Yeah.
And so I would imagine that even if you do factor in all the shipping and all that kind of stuff, it's still going to be easier to get a Japanese version of the system than it is to get an American version of the system.
Yeah.
When we're talking about Atlantean, I do have a question for you. I want to know how you got that beautiful scrolling backgrounds that you got in that game. Because the one downside of, and this is a little bit technical here, if we haven't already gotten technical, but the one downside of the PC Engine is that it doesn't have very good scrolling, or at least the parallax scrolling is not really there. And to explain this, okay, so in the real world, you're walking down the street, and I'm going to use Mount Fuji for an example here because I can see it from my window, okay? If I'm walking down the street, if I look towards the direction of Mount Fuji, the fence that's behind me as I'm walking is moving. It appears to be moving, okay? And it's moving pretty quickly. If you're standing right beside the fence posts, those posts are moving at a pretty quick rate, and they have kind of a flicker almost of the as the gaps between each fence post goes in front of your eyes. If you look up a little bit from that, the trees maybe are moving a little bit slower visually. It appears that way. And then if you look at trees that are further in the background, maybe 50 feet away, they're not appearing to move as quickly because your field of vision is different. And then when you look at Mount Fuji, it's not moving at all. It's static, and everything else is kind of moving. The closer you get, the more it appears to be moving. And a lot of video games try to reproduce this effect, and it can be very difficult to do because really to do it properly, you need to have a bunch of layers. And so the Super Nintendo has several different background layers in it or something in it, and I think it actually has some hardware that's designed to help these layers scroll at different speeds and create this sort of what's known as parallaxing look, okay? And PC Engine's really not very good at this. If you look at Ease 3, when you're walking through the town at the beginning of the game, if you're walking through the Redmont town or whatever, the background in the back looks really bad because what it has to do is it has to redraw that background every time you move because it can't scroll it separately from the rest, so it has to instead just redraw it line by line, like a little section of pixels as you walk down the town has to then be redrawn to make it look like it's moving at a different speed than the rest, the foreground is. And so that's a really choppy looking process. Atlantean does something similar to that, but looks like butter in the ocean. Okay, as it just looks fantastic. How does you make Atlantean look so good?
Well, there's like a couple tricks to play. What sucks though is that there's still some slowdown. I'm trying to think how to explain. Like most of it, like the PC Engine can. I guess there's a misconception between parallax and layering.
Okay. Like,
you use layering to make the parallax look better because the PC Engine can do parallax, but that's just every line horizontally scrolling at a different speed.
Oh, okay.
So we're doing that, and then what we do after that is the extra effect that sucks on the PC Engine is that we don't have the extra background layer. So to create that layering where stuff passes over each other, that's what makes parallax look really good.
Yeah.
So we use sprites for like the little rooftops in the front row. It's like sprite little rooftops that move along with the background.
Mm-hmm.
And they're on top of the layer behind it. So you've created a layer that way. But what sucks is you're using sprites. And that's the same thing with like the coral, big tower, like coral pieces that move around.
Uh-huh.
That's all like sprite work. The other way is, like, some games use dynamic tile updating, which is, I guess, it doesn't use sprites, but there's less you can do, I guess, because you're constantly updating background tiles, and you have to do more art finagling and, like, more careful planning. And usually those kind of effects, there's not as much detail in the tiles that are updating. Whereas, like, in Atlantean, like, those giant purpley-pink coral things that move around, like, doing that as dynamic tile updating would have been, like, mental, but there's this extra secret trick that I used that a lot of people, like, I guess don't think about. The back layer of the buildings, it's also roofs, like the little, like, blue dome thingies.
Uh-huh.
They're background tiles, but the sprites for the coral pass behind them, so it's like there's a trick to that. How do I explain this so that it's not confusing?
Okay, we'll give it a try. So,
yeah, the back row of sprites or of roofs, it's using color zero of the background around, like, the blue part is background color zero.
Uh-huh.
The bottom row of the coral, like, it's the bottom, like, 16 by 16 row of the coral pieces, those are sprites, but they're given priority behind the background. What that means is if they're behind the background, they are invisible, but they're visible if they're passing through color zero of the background.
Oh.
So the rest of the background, like the blue, like watery background,
mm-hmm.
that's all not color zero. So nothing shows through it, but right. that very bottom row of color zero, the sprites that are behind it can show through it, and since the domes use the other colors, like colors like, you know, 1 through 15,
mm-hmm.
they appear on top of the sprite.
I see.
But the rest of it behind it, so it's like a trick to get, you can fudge an extra layer. The downside is you have to use color zero, so
right,
you're sort of limited in what you can do with that trick because it's color zero. Like, a lot of times it's like, oh, you can use that for, like, black to, like, have things pass under things, like, for outer space crap and stuff. But that's the extra trick I use to avoid having to use more stupid nonsense to get layering.
I see.
Had I not done that, I would have had to use more sprites on the back layer of the roof tiles. And I didn't want to do that.
I see.
Because then, yeah, like, the more sprites you use,
you get slow down and stuff, I guess, right?
Yeah, and you can only have 256 pixels worth of sprites per line before it clips. And if you're wasting a lot of your sprites on stupid background effects, it's like suddenly the things you care about in the game are invisible or blipping around.
Yeah, that, it's like this background looks so beautiful that we can't actually put any enemies on it, so enjoy exploring nothing.
Right, so it's like that fine line between, you know, cool looking and practical. And because of the way Atlantean works, that's the thing that sucks, is every game we make has some stupid oversight where we didn't really think about the fact that, like, it looks dumb, but it's actually doing a lot of computation. Like, Insanity had this problem where literally everything in the game can touch everything, and if it touches it, it dies. So you have to do collision checks for every robot to see if it's touching a wall, and then every robot to see if it's touching another wall, and then every robot to see if it's touching the player, and then all the shots can touch the player, the player shots can touch the robots, everything can touch each other. So there's like this astronomical amount of collision checks. And that it's such
poor processor has only got 8 bits to work with, right?
Yeah, and it's such a goofy looking game, but really there's more collision computations in that stupid game than there are in like Hudson's vertical shooters, and it's crazy to think about, but it's a thing. And it's just, you know, lesson learned, don't do that.
But do you get slowdowns with that, or does it manage it?
We managed to fudge it where it was okay. The game runs slow in general, but like it purposely that way, because if it runs at 60 frames per second, it's kind of unplayable. But yeah, you will get a little slowdown when, like, sometimes you enter a room where there's like, you know, 10 robots and they all shoot at the same time, and it's like that's unavoidable. And it was like, it's the first thing we made, calm down. But Atlantean has similar problems because, you know, in a vertical shooter like, you know, Star Soldier, when stuff leaves the screen, it's gone.
Right.
In Atlantean, when stuff leaves the screen, it still has to be processed because it's still alive. Mm. And I'm tracking, I think it's 3 screens worth of stuff permanently. Like, the whole level, like, you have to track the little guys that are off screen that can be abducted. And all the enemies, all that stuff, even if they're not in the, like, 256 pixel wide window that you can see, they're still doing stuff. So all that crap's always happening. So it wastes processor time. And then this stupid radar that you need for the game to be playable. Like, updating that radar is so costly. Because it's not bitmap like, you know, an 8-bit machine or a computer. Or like the Defender game cabinet was all a blitter. So you could just blit pixels however you wanted. And it was fine. For the PC Engine, you are updating a tile in memory and it's slow. So like, all that crap happening with the stuff moving around causes the radar to be needed. Every frame, the radar has to update and update where pixels have ended up for, like, enemies and stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, and it sucks because it created, like, needless slowdown. Because, like, I actually experimented, if I turn the radar off, there's, like, no slowdown in the game just by turning the radar off. Whoops. And it's like, man, but you need the radar or the game isn't playable because you can't see where stuff is at.
Right.
Like, it's, like, a requirement for that game to work. But the game still, I mean, the slowdown's not too bad. It's still a perfectly playable game.
It's still just impressive enough that somebody was able to release a fully playable game on HuCard 20-something years after the system died. And I think just the fact that someone cares enough to do that anyway is always impressive to me. When I talk to homebrew people, like for example, John Hasink, who does MSX stuff, or... you know, the people doing the PC-98 translations and stuff. There are people in Japan who are sitting there and they say, why is anybody doing this? Like, they're developers, when you show them fan translations for some of these old games, these developers are just like, I didn't know anyone even knew this game existed anymore. And they're like, oh yeah, it has this big following in the country and we decided to translate it, and now, like, there's a whole lot of people talking about it. And people in Japan are always blown away that people care about old stuff. Because the, like, viewpoint here is, everything has a time limit. And then once it reaches that time limit, it's like a flower that's past its, you know, it's gone. It needs to fall from the tree and go away because the cycle has to continue and something new has to come up. And, like, retro has become a big thing here recently, but retro homebrew still hasn't. Whereas in the West, it's like it's becoming this big thing. And so Japanese people are just terribly amazed. And when you look at something like the TurboGrafx, which has a moderate following in US, but as far as like the American systems, but the Japanese systems are becoming really popular. You know, Japanese people can't understand why. And that, to me, it makes me happy to take something and say, hey, look, this is why. Because it's cool, or because it's fun, or because it's history, or because it's all those things put together. I mean, that's the reason I'm doing this podcast in a lot of ways, because it's just so neat to go back and look at these things and say, what can we do with this today in 2019? So, last thoughts. Do you have anything you'd like to say or anything you'd like to promote?
Well, it's not PC Engine, but you can check out the latest thing we did was Inferno for the MSX. But
yeah. And you have a website, aetherbyte.com, which is A-E-T-H-E-R. And then
Oh, man, that whole thing, the way that name came up, man, what was I thinking?
what did happen with that?
Well, originally, you know, I was like, oh, man, I'm one of those cool guys now. I'm going to start a software thing. You know, all these, like, you know, cracker groups and stuff back in the 80s have had those cool names for their groups. Like, one was, like, Cosine. Those dudes are awesome. But originally, it was, like, my idea was, like, it was, like, called, like, Surreal Software.
Hmm.
And it turns out that was already a thing.
Sure, that probably was, yeah.
And I'm like, damn it. So I ended up sitting there, like, racking my brain trying to come up with something cool. And somehow I was just looking up other words for, like, heaven and stuff. Because, like, yeah, we want to be, like, the cool, like, awesome, like, heavenly best thing ever. And, you know, the Aether came up. And it worked out because, like, you know, we have, like, you know, megabyte, kilobyte, and all that crap. So I just put Aether in front of byte.
Ah, okay. And it is Aether, right? Not Aether. I was trying to Aether, but it really should be Aether.
Well, it depends.
Right?
Japanese people will say Aether because that's how they would pronounce it. But Aether, it's all the same. It depends on your accent. Either is acceptable, I think.
Okay.
I say Aetherbyte. Well, sometimes I'll say Aether. Depends, I guess, how fast I'm talking.
Mm.
But the other catch was, like, you know, what we were working on was an 8-bit processor. So, like, 8 bits makes a byte. So it was all like, right. Hey. And that's how it happened. And that's how, like, the logo, it's got the funny, like, the original logo, it's not on the website anymore. But the logo, the first one, I made it myself. And I suck at art. But the thing was, like, since it's a Greek word and a Greek concept, like, I put, like, those Greek pillars on either side of the word. That's the whole reason there's that pillar there, and I don't know why I did that. It was just like, yeah, this is awesome.
To me, they look like lights. I guess they're, like light pillars or something to me.
Yeah, the original ones, I took, like, a picture of a pillar and then shrunk it down and then sat there for, like, 6 hours because I suck at art, and I was, like, trying to draw, like, those cool traces like Tron has, and it looks so demented. But, like, if you look at Insanity has that logo in the manual and on the title, like the splash screen when the game starts. That's, like, the initial logo I made. But then our art guy now, like, the first game we made, I did all the art because I wasn't sure if we'd finish the game. I didn't want to waste anyone's time. But now we have Paul, like, with Sun Team. He does all the art, so he fixed the logos and made our art not suck. But yeah, the initial stuff was all, like, my art, and it looks horrible.
By the way, Sun Team Paul, that's a great resource if you're really interested in learning about PC Engine. PC Engine Bible, I think?
Yeah, he's got the PC Engine Software Bible, and he has the new PC Engine Forum. You can get it from the Software Bible. Like, since PCEFX, like, that whole PC Engine FX forum died.
Yeah.
It's officially, as of, like, the 20th of January, was set to read only, so you can't even register or post there anymore.
Oh, wow.
So the new forum is on the PC Engine Software Bible forum you can get to. That's where we've all migrated to, and then there's a Discord chat that you can get to, and I think he links to that also on his site. So I think just going straight to his Software Bible is great if you want to go interact with people.
And if you haven't gotten a chance to really mess with this system before, go online and research it, and then look at some of the emulators. If you have a Wii, there's a lot you can do with the Wii in terms of PC Engine. If you don't want to spend the money on the actual hardware right away, because it is a bit of an investment to get into this platform. Not as much as other things. Definitely not as much as, like, PC-98 or any of that kind of stuff. But if you want to, like, learn about this system and what it's all about, you know, watch some videos online, see some the cutscenes and things, and it'll really blow you away, I think. Because when I watch cutscenes from some of the early games, like Dracula X, okay, that's 1991. I mean, that's before, like, if I remember correctly, that's like 2 years before the X-Files comes out. It's before Super Mario World. I mean, it's way, way early, and it looks so good. So there's just a lot of, like, really impressive stuff in context. The system is incredibly impressive. And if you haven't played any of the games, if you haven't messed with it, really do. Check out Newtopia. And there's going to be more about that later. Newtopia is going to be talked about in another episode. It's like a Zelda clone that blows Zelda out of the water in pretty much every way up until, you know, Link to the Past comes out. But even for the Hue card games, you know, every good arcade game that was ported to the NES has a better PC Engine release. And a lot of great companies, Konami, Falcom, Who else? Did Capcom do much for PC Engine? I mean, Street Fighter and...
No, not really, no.
Yeah, I think they did a couple. Namco did a lot of stuff.
Well, there's also a bunch of like random weird games. Like there's this game called Gamola Speed. I think people should go check that game out. And you rarely hear a game like that come up. There's a bunch of weird games.
Oh yeah, there's some really bizarre stuff out there for PC Engine.
Mm. Like go through Paul's the software bible because he's done a great job of it. It's all alphabetical. Every page you go to. For a game, he usually puts like three games at the bottom that are kind of similar, so you can keep finding similar stuff to try. And it's probably the best way to explore it is to just use his site and poke your way through games.
Yeah, that's something that I used to do actually when I was learning about the system, was to just go through that site and just research and find out other games that were similar, and it was really, really awesome tool. So definitely recommend that. That's the PC Engine Software Bible.
Yep, and you can... He's got it linked to his other, like, Sun Team-related projects, because he does some PC Engine-ish stuff for PC and Game Maker for fun, and sometimes I help him with the music for it.
Didn't he used to have a magazine as well?
Oh, well, he puts out, like, those books and some other stuff.
Yeah.
He does a lot of really fancy, like, cool, like, game-related projects and, like, books and printed stuff. He's really great at that stuff. So there's a lot of stuff. If you just click around on Sun Team in general, there's all kinds of stuff. It's not just PC Engine related, too, so you can find other stuff.
My last question before we leave here is, which did you find more enjoyable, programming for the MSX or programming for the PC Engine?
Well, I guess it depends what you mean by enjoyable. the MSX is easier to work with for the simple reasons are... Since it was a computer, it was well documented and openly documented for human beings to use.
Indeed.
So, and the Z80 is easier to program to me because it's got 16-bit operations, whereas the PC Engine doesn't. But in the PC Engine, you know, since it was a closed game console, you didn't just go to the store and buy like the PC Engine instruction book.
Right.
So doing stuff, it was all reverse engineered. So sometimes the tools suck. And you run into weird problems because of stuff like that. So it's just like hack job, like for fun, reverse engineering and stuff. But really, like I prefer the PC Engine over the MSX. So the end result is like I like the PC Engine games that I've made more than Inferno, even though I like Inferno. Because the PC Engine is like I grew up more with the TurboGrafx, so it's got a different feel.
Well, there's also something to be said for working hard to make something come to life. Like, it's MSX, for me, MSX, making an MSX game would be a lot of work. But for someone who's really, really, really skilled in this stuff or really experienced with this stuff already, the comparison of making a PC Engine game to making an MSX game is, it's probably no comparison at all, because there is so much documentation and such a huge community out there of people that are making MSX games.
Yeah.
And then there's you.
Yeah, the MSX has a much older community and lots of utilities and discussions and, you know, arguments. But, like, lots of people who are familiar with working on stuff that made it a lot easier. It was a lot less painful to make. But in the PC Engine, I guess there was a lot more, like, uncharted territory and, like...
Labor of love.
And we were, like, winging it for a lot of stuff to get things to work. And I think overall...
With the plastic, it sure sounds like it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, burning down your house, practically.
Yeah, like, you know, electroplating in the garage with a fish tank. Yeah. So I think overall, like, the PC Engine has more fun stories involved with all the games. The MSX was just a straightforward, like, yeah, we made a game in Z80 assembly with all these tools that were available. Whereas PC Engine was like, hey, we didn't know if any of this was going to work, and it turns out it worked. So it's like there's better stories because of it, I guess.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining me, and thank you very much for sharing PC Engine love to our listeners.
No problem. Glad I could help.
Sure. And let us know whenever you have any new PC Engine products coming out. At the very least, we'll promote it, even if I don't end up finding a chance to buy it. I would like to, though.
That'd be cool. I think we're always toying around with ideas of, like, you know, we released the little free games and stuff, so we're always thinking about stuff. But, like, we're not done doing PC Engine stuff. We'll be doing more.
Thank you very much for listening to Doors and Dungeons. Again, your host, Michelle Belmont. And I just want to say thank you very much to our guest. And as usual things, of course, there's Patreon, Doors and Dungeons on Patreon. Also, there's Twitter, at DoorDun Podcast. That's at Door, D-U-N, Podcast. Follow us there. Also, you can check out the new Instagram. I believe that's Doors and Dungeons. Also, we have the Discord server, so check that out and come and talk. So before I leave, I want to give you a sneak peek into the next episode. We're going to be doing a collaboration with another podcast. It's Platforms and Pitfalls and my friend Rowan Carmichael, who is going to join me and Tom Lipschultz to talk about three Castlevania games that are considered to be unpopular, but also quite good in their own ways.
The whip is fast, and everything looks a bit choppy. Those were the two things that I really noticed very quickly.
If you're a fan of Castlevania, you do not want to miss this one. All right, we'll see you next time. This has been Doors and Dungeons. Goodbye.